Number nine, true spiritual consolation is deeply interior. The norm in this consolation is spiritual. It's in the spirit. Words fail us. Well, let's say this. Peaches are inside of a can. I had some puffed rice this morning. That's inside of a box. So the word inside or interior have all sorts of varying material connotations. We have to use the verb, otherwise we wouldn't be talking. But there are depths and depths of interiority. From another viewpoint, there are layers and layers to our being. True consolation is in the deepest recesses of the human spirit where God and grace abide. And as we've been saying all along, that joy, therefore, may coexist with the absence of satisfaction in the outer layers of my being. I just read, in fact, it was yesterday morning, that a woman who died in an obscure town of France, bedridden for 50 years, when she died, some 20 times the population of the town came to her funeral. Bishops from distant parts of France, several hundred priests. She lived immobile physically for 50 years, and only after her death did her confessor reveal that she had experienced the stigmata of Christ and had given counsel to bishops and cardinals all over the world, suffering all these years. I just want to illustrate what I mean by number nine. This is interior joy, which by prior definition, therefore, may coexist with the very opposite of satisfaction or pleasure in the outer layer of one's being. Finally, a true spiritual consolation is patient, which in my vocabulary as a norm means it is consistent with the cross. In fact, it is proved by the cross. Its experience is, with rare exception, commissioned by the cross. Now, that doesn't mean that a person need be engrossed to lengthen suffering in order to experience the spiritual consolation we're talking about. That's just to make sure that they are not considered somehow incompatible with joy with Christ crucified, in order for the patient to not only not complain to others, but does not, which is much higher, even complain to herself. And yet, we might, in a way, consider the fact that it could pay to complain in prayer, as some of the great mystics have done, as in the case of Saint Teresa, when speaking to the Lord, "Well, no wonder you've got so few friends. Look how you treat them." Well, the Lord let her say that because she was, after all, a human being, and that was an effectual prayer, a cry for help, as Christ in his agony in Gethsemane. I distinguish, therefore, among three types of complaints. Complain to others? Never. Complain to self as much as you can keep yourself from doing. Complain to God? Well, in a way, this is constancy to our God, because any complaining to God ceases to be complaining. It is, in effect, a plea for help. And if the Son of God in Gethsemane can pray, Father, can you let this chalice pass from me? Well, there may be times in our lives when we are driven to ask the Lord to relieve us. Whether he does or not is up to him. If he does not, he will give you the strength. Either way, his will be done. But all the while, yes, all your while, his will be done. Whatever suffering or cross, it is what this is all about. There is, nevertheless, notwithstanding, in spite of the fact that a long list, as you approach the sufferings of Christ, we may experience a deep down interior satisfaction of spirit borne away that must be experienced in order to be understood. Our next talk or lecture concerns dryness of soul. Dryness of soul can be described spiritually as a state of soul devoid of sensible consolation, which makes it very difficult to pray. So that state of soul or spirit in which there is an absence of spiritual consolation, or better, sensible consolation that makes prayer not impossible, but difficult. Four general causes are recognized in spiritual thought. It may be something that is physical, for example, illness, a bad headache, an upset stomach, or simply some kind of chronic sickness or disease, which may go on for months or years. There is a relationship between body and spirit. Secondly, it may be the result of voluntary self-indulgence or sinful indulgence of self. In other words, if you want to pray or teach others how to pray, be sure to tell them the first norm of successful prayer is leading a selfless life. Self-indulgence hinders prayer. Third, it may simply be an act of God. That can continue for some length of time. Now, God just enters in order to try the soul. In fact, he does. Constantly sustained, unruffled years, long consolation in prayer is suspect. It's either not real consolation, or it isn't a good prayer. God tries his followers by having them pray even when they do not experience consolation. And fourth, it may be, and it has been in the lives of all the saints, a sign of special grace. That doesn't mean that all dryness in prayer is the result of a special grace. the dryness in my prayer may be the result of a special self-indulgence, which has no grace. Are we clear? But God can send dryness as a special grace. The third thing that I wanted to point out is to distinguish dryness of soul from desolation. Dryness is the absence of consolation, whereas desolation is a presence of the opposite. Turmoil, restlessness, disturbance, sadness, darkness. In these ultimates of the spiritual life, the best you can do is to describe and trust that those who either read or hear about, in this case, dryness and desolation, know what it means from experience. Dryness is the absence of consolation. Desolation is the opposite of consolation. For example, when I'm awake, I can be experiencing pleasure, or I can be experiencing pain. While I'm asleep, I'm not conscious of either. Dryness is a kind of, well, you might say, a sleepy state of the spiritual life. The soul is simply not alert, not awake. Desolation, of course, is much worse. How to cope? Well, I have five rules that I have used with souls over the years. First rule, that's for ourselves and others that we may be directing. Find out what may be the cause of the dryness. Why am I, as it were, a drowsy, asleep, just cold in my life of prayer? And consequently, the four causes that we identified above are important. Either remove the cause or live with the effect. In other words, either the cause of my dryness is something that should be removed because it is wrong, like sinful self-indulgence, or it isn't wrong, it's remedial, like an open-heart surgery. Are we clear? And a lot of people, for years, may be suffering dryness of spirit, and what they need is a good physical examination, and maybe medical surgery. I'm just repeating that the condition of our body has a lot to do with the state of our soul. Take it from a veteran. Or if it's not something removable, resign yourself to live with it. Now, I wouldn't dare at this point in time to identify what the situation is or the remedy I proposed, but since my heart surgery, I've lined up 7 reasons why I should live with a certain state of body. But we've got to convince ourselves. Otherwise, we'll only be fighting the inevitable. In other words, there are things we simply have to live with. Now, second recommendation, if the cause is culpable, then work to remove that cause. And in general, it is failure to do God's will. It is tempting God to expect him to bless me with the grace of fervent prayer if, in other aspects of my life, I am not doing his will. One of the great benefits of an annual retreat, a monthly day of recollection, or a daily examination of conscience is to find out where I have failed in doing God's will, because by removing that failure, I will immensely improve my life of prayer. And reading books by Teresa of Avila is not the answer. knowing all the subtle distinctions of ascetical and mystical theology is not the answer. The single most important contributing factor to follow in prayer is doing God's will during the day. If I do His will during the day, He will, to coin a phrase, do my will when I pray. Third, if the cause is inculpable, still try to remove it. It is not germinal. If, for example, my state of body, or whatever circumstance we are in, the work I'm doing, in the climate outside, the diet I'm eating, whatever. In other words, if it interferes with my life of prayer, I should try to remove that obstacle to good prayer. In other words, I should try to remove what from experience I know interferes with my practice of prayer. And if it's something that God has put into my life that I find makes prayer more difficult, it is not a bad idea to ask God to remove it if it's His will. Number four, if the cause of the dryness of soul is unknown, do not worry about the aridity. Now, don't spend sleepless nights trying to figure out why I am dry in prayer. In other words, it is simply part of God's providence to try His chosen ones with a certain amount of dryness in prayer. And finally, from experience, try to find out if the aridity or coldness, the dryness, the lack of interest, keeps you from praying as well as you should. Well, you might say, of course it's keeping me from praying the way I should. I don't feel right. That's not the point. Provided I keep praying and pray faithfully, no matter how dry I may be, God is pleased. What is most important in the spiritual life is not the satisfaction. There's no more important negative in the spiritual life. What matters before God is not the personal satisfaction I get out of doing God's will, or here, even out of praying. What really matters is that I'm honestly trying to pray. As long as I'm honestly trying to pray, I don't feel like it. No matter. I keep praying. But the rules that we gave in the beginning, the four causes, should always be examined. One of the first rules that I recommend to those who direct souls is to try to make sure whether the dryness of spirit is caused by sinful self-indulgence or not.